Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. St. Norbert would be very happy, or maybe, in fact, very happy if he's paying attention today. We've got two Norbertine priests with us. Second hour, Father Hugh Barber, our chaplain, will be the chaplain is in, we call that hour. He will be in to do some chaplaining. And this hour, Father Sebastian Walsh, our guest from the same community of St. Michael's, the Abbey of St. Michael up in the Diocese of Orange, California. Our topic this hour, situational ethics. Are moral laws fixed for all situations, or are there contexts in which particular moral laws might change or be overridden? In other words, in what ways does the situation determine what's right and what's wrong, rather than universal principles determining what's right and what's wrong? Situational ethics is our topic this hour. And if you have questions about how ethics should be applied in real situations, please give us a call, 888-318-7884. Again, as I said, our guest this hour, Father Sebastian Walsh, a Norbertine canon of the Abbey of St. Michael. He completed his studies at St. Thomas Aquinas College in California and then continued on to the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C., receiving a license in philosophy, and later attended the Pontifical University of St. Thomas in Rome, the Angelicum, where he received a master's in sacred theology and a doctorate in philosophy. Father Sebastian Walsh, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Si. Thank you.
So is situational ethics the same as relativism?
It's not exactly the same. Let me give you kind of a description or a definition of situational ethics. Situational ethics is a kind of an explanation of morality or, you know, our experience of good and bad actions, which holds that no human act can be determinately judged as right or wrong until all the morally relevant situations or circumstances are known. Okay? So what would be one of the consequences of this? This would mean, for example, that all human actions could be right in one set of situations, but wrong if I change the set of situations. So it would be a little bit like this. Human actions would be like numbers. If I take any given number, if I add another number, I could make it odd or I could make it even, depending on what number I add.
Okay.
Something like that is what situational ethics does. They say, take any act, any human act, whatever description it has, whatever determination you describe it as. If you add another situation, you can always make it either good or bad, depending on the situation you add. So this obviously excludes the possibility that there's universal commandments that are always applicable to a moral situation. So in that sense, it's like moral relativity, that it excludes the possibility of an always universal moral precept or commandment that's always applicable.
Well, so are there things that are true about situational ethics and then things that are false about it? Or do we say it's entirely false? Or how do we think of it?
Yeah, just like we would say if we were to say that a statement is a statement entirely true or false, if it's false in any regard, it's going to be false altogether. So simply speaking, it's a false theory. But there's something true. Some elements of situational ethics are true, but there's others that are false. So, for example, it's true that we can never definitively judge an act as good without knowing the relevant moral circumstances. It could be good in its kind. For example, feeding the poor. I could say, well, that's generically good. But what if I add a circumstance like I'm doing it because I hate someone else and my motive is out of hatred, even though I'm actually doing something that's, you know, feeding the poor or something like that.
Right.
But what's false about situational ethics is this. An act cannot be determinately judged as bad. So situational ethics basically says, no matter what an act looks like, if I add a situation, I can change it from bad to good. And that's not true. That's the false part of situational ethics. There's no such thing, for example, as a good way to do adultery. There's no such thing as a situation that will make torturing a child or molesting a child good. No situation can actually turn that into a good thing. And the reason for that is the following. Goodness comes from all the essential principles of some action being there together. It comes from totality. It comes from everything that should be there being there. Evil comes about if even one essential component is missing. So let me give a parallel example just from the natural world first. Let's say that I've got a horse, and I say, is that a good horse or is that not a good horse from the standpoint of what horses are supposed to do? And I say, well, okay, it's obviously identifiable as a horse. It's got, you know, beautiful shiny coat. It looks nice, but it's got just one leg that's half as long as all the others. All I have to do is have one thing wrong with it, and then the whole horse has got a fundamentally bad disposition as a horse. It can't run anymore, can't fulfill its purpose as a horse. Huh?
Uh-huh.
Similarly with moral actions. You know, I could have all sorts of good things in a moral action, but as soon as there's one essential element that's bad about a moral action, now the whole action becomes bad, right? So once I've got, for example, an act that's adultery, I can't now make it good by adding some circumstance. I can't make torturing a child good by some circumstance. I can't make murder good by some circumstance. Once it's got badness in it, that's in some way irrevocable. And that's why universal negative precepts like commandments, you shall not kill, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not lie, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those are always applicable everywhere because you know as soon as you've got a moral act that fits that description, no circumstance, no situation can remedy that. And therefore, there are such things as universal moral norms, negative universal moral norms, that are always applicable. And you can, in every case, know that anything that falls under that universal is still going to be a bad act.
Situational ethics is our topic this hour. Our guest, Father Sebastian Walsh, give us a call, 888-318-7884. If you have a question about how situational ethics works and how ethics properly works, 888-318-7884. What about there's a kind of Christian situational ethics. And at the moment, I'm thinking of someone like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who said the only law that matters is the law of love. So I guess his idea is that as long as you're doing what love demands in any given situation, then you're following all the precepts of the law, of the moral law.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, someone could say something like this, a parallel example. As long as you're doing God's will, you're always going to be doing something right. You know?
And oh, I see.
That's a completely valid statement. But of course, then the question becomes, in the concrete, what does it mean to do God's will?
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, someone can say, as long as you're doing it out of love, authentic love, charity, love for God, it's inspired by God, then who can doubt that what you're doing is going to be right? But then concretely, what does it mean to love, right? Jesus gives us very concrete ways of knowing whether or not we're acting in accordance with love. And what is one of the signs he gives? You know that you are that you have loved me if you keep my commandments, right? It's a very, St. John is very clear about in his first epistle, that's going to be the measure of whether or not you're really loving. And so who can doubt that there are universal principles that are always applicable from the standpoint of as long as you do this, you'll always be acting well. But the truth of the matter is it's difficult to know when you're doing
yes.
God's will, when you are loving. And
right.
That's exactly what ethics is for. Moral theology is helpful in finding out exactly how do I love? How do I do God's will?
Right, so I might easily, left to my own devices, say that well, the loving thing to do in a particular situation, for example, is to take the life of an innocent person. That's the, and so I need that the clarity of revelation there or of reason to
yes.
say no, that you can't ever cross that line. Doesn't matter what
that's
the
right.
situation is.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly right. The truth of the matter is that you know, we can deceive ourselves, and very often. We think that what we feel like doing in a given circumstance is the right thing, or what society, you know, kind of generally agrees upon is the right thing.
Right.
But all sorts of terrible things have happened with those principles of work. So we need an ethics, a real ethics, that actually conforms to reality and actually accounts for the moral, our moral experience the way it really is.
888-318-7884 is our number. Father Sebastian Walsh is our guest. We're talking situational ethics, and we'll be happy to take your calls right after this when we come back on Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, this is Archbishop Alexander Sample of the Archdiocese of Portland in Oregon. Keep that dial right here on Catholic Answers Live.
Just like the saints of the Counter-Reformation, our own souls are in constant need of reform, of reconversion to God and His will for us. We struggle with sin. We become distracted in prayer. We find it hard to be loving and easy to be selfish. In Reform Yourself, Sean McAfee shows you how these magnificent saints can be guides to your own personal transformation. We all need to reform our souls. Let the saints who reformed the church show you how. Order your copy of Reform Yourself today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Pope Francis said, "The key that opens the door to faith is prayer." Join St. Paul Street Evangelization by running a prayer station in the public square. You don't need to be a professional apologist or theologian. Just listen to the needs of the people you encounter. Offer encouragement, take prayer requests, and pray with people. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpa. In Luke 14:12, when Jesus dined at the home of a leading Pharisee, he told him in the future to invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind. Blessed will that host be because of such people's inability to pay him back. Our Lord was concerned that we show the same generosity to those in need that He has shown to us. For example, my grandparents lived on a farm near a railroad track. They weren't wealthy, but each Thanksgiving and Christmas they would set up an extra table in the garden for the hobos that would come for dinner. One year, a hobo who hadn't come for several years was surprised that my grandmother was still alive. He told her, "I thought you'd be in heaven by now." He instinctively knew that such generosity does not go unnoticed by the Lord. To whom have we shown such generosity lately? I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Father Sebastian Walsh, our guest this hour, and our topic is situational ethics. How do we make ethical determinations in a specific situation? And is it the case? Well, actually, Father has led us away from this idea that the situation itself determines the ethics. If we know what the situation is, we know what to do. That is not the case. 888-318-7884, our number. CJ in Reno, Nevada, listening on 920 AM. You are on with Father Sebastian Walsh. Your question, please.
Yeah, thanks so much. I heard, Father Walsh, you said earlier that it's always wrong to lie. And so there's that old philosophical question that I've never fully understood. And the hypothetical is this. If I'm, say, concealing people during World War II from the Nazis,
sure,
and I'm concealing a person, they come to the door and say, "Is so-and-so there?" And I know that they're there and I'm concealing them. Am I permitted to lie, or do I have to say, "Yes, that person is here"?
Yes, you're not the only one that's heard that case. It's a very common case as a supposed instance of when it's okay to lie. But the Church, first of all, in the Catechism, is very clear that it is never permitted under any circumstances to lie. Jesus himself said, "I am the truth." Huh? I am the truth. So how do we deal with a situation like that where it seems like it would be wrong to tell the truth? Huh? The first thing to see is that you don't have to tell the truth in that case because those people don't deserve to know the truth. Sometimes you have to tell the truth. Like if your parents ask you, "Were you out with the car last night?" then they deserve to know, so you definitely have to tell them the truth. But if you have these Nazis that are coming to round up people unjustly and put them to death, they don't deserve to know the truth. And therefore, you don't have to tell them the truth, okay? But on the other hand, it doesn't follow from that that you can lie. And let me manifest this a little bit more. Let's say that you do lie. Let's say the Nazis come to the door and they say, "Are you hiding any Jews in your house?" And you lie. And then the Nazis just decide to search your house anyway. In other words, the truth is that your lie never saved the Jews in your house in the first place. If you lie, they could have the thing that really saves their life is the fact that the Nazi soldiers decided not to search the house. And they may or may not decide to search the house whether or not you lie to them or not. Do you understand? And so the lie itself is not connected to the salvation of the people that you're concealing. Okay? In fact, the reason why the lie would have worked in the first place is because the soldiers trust that you're telling the truth. And by lying, you're actually corrupting that trust. You're actually objectively corrupting the foundation of human trust that people are speaking truthfully when they interact with one another. So what could you do in a circumstance like that? One thing you could do is you could tell them something true that they would be likely to misunderstand. I'll give you a funny example. So this, a Nazi soldier comes and he says, are there any Jews concealed in your house? And you say, there are no Jewish dogs in my house, like that. It's true. There's no Jewish dogs in the house. You don't have a dog in the house. There's only Jewish people in the house. And you're saying a true statement. It's not a lie. Simply speaking, it's true. There's actually a famous case, too, where a woman had hidden some Jews in her cellar, and they put she put a carpet and a table over the trap door to the cellar. And when the soldiers came and asked her if she was hiding any Jews, she said, yes, they're right there under the table, and laughed so that the soldiers would misunderstand her to think that they were just sitting there under the table. But in fact, she was telling the truth. They were under the table. So there are ways in which you could get around that circumstance without actually lying. Now, all that being said, if it happens that you're just sitting there and you just can't think of a way and you lie as a result of just not being able to think of a way of deceiving them cleverly where you're telling the truth, it would clearly be a very minor sin, if a sin at all. In other words, it might be just an imperfection or maybe just a small venial sin or something like that in that case. But it's a different thing to say that it's good than to say that it's not seriously wrong. Okay, so there's really two different situations there where you're, when you're dealing with a very difficult situation, sometimes you can't think on your feet, and to lie in a situation like that would be a very small fault. Nevertheless, we can't say that it's good. It's intrinsically bad. I hope that answers your question.
Yes, that's great. Thank you.
All right, sure. CJ, thank you very, very much. 888-318-7884, our number. Father Sebastian Walsh, taking your calls on situational ethics. We go now to Anonymous in Tulsa, Oklahoma, listening on St. Michael Radio. Anonymous, your question for Father Walsh.
Hello. My question sort of follows on the previous question about who has the right to know the truth.
Yeah,
I am dealing with a parent that has been interfering a bit too much in my marriage, and I was wondering originally if I should lie to him about questions so that he'd stop prying to get answers that he's looking for, or what else could I say to throw him off so he doesn't keep asking that isn't lying then?
Well, you rightly have surmised that lying is an example of something you can never do. I don't know the particular circumstances of your situation with your parents, but in principle this is true, that parents of a married man don't have the right to know everything that's happening in their marriage. That's, you're a married man, and so they no longer have authority over you. They do have some kind of the same role that every Christian brother would have in being interested in your salvation and your good and whatever else. So they, and obviously you want your parents to be as involved in your life as they can be and should be. But if they are asking questions that they shouldn't, that they don't have a right to know or they shouldn't be asking, then at that point you can do one of two things. You can just simply tell them, look, that's not appropriate for you to ask those questions, and in the future I just want you, please don't ask those questions in the future because that's not something that you need to know the answer to. Do it politely and kindly, as is becoming a child to his parent. Or you could say something that was true But, you know, but again, was the sort of thing that, you know, that they might not understand fully, or it's just they only understand part of the truth or something like that. You could say something like that. I would recommend just being very direct and straightforward with them, though, and just say, look, you know, I know you're interested in these things, and, you know, but look, I'm a married man, and I've got to be responsible for the things that are in my marriage, and you have to recognize there are limits or boundaries to what your involvement in my married life. So that's what I would do in a case like that, okay?
Okay, yes. Thank you, Father.
Sure thing. God bless you.
Thank you, Anonymous. 888-318-7884, our number. We're discussing situational ethics with Father Sebastian Walsh. You know, Father, I was for some reason, your answer about protecting Jews from Nazis, isn't
yes.
a lot of statecraft, particularly in the military, involves deceiving others? Like you,
yeah.
Deception is an important part of like military functions
yeah.
and all that.
Yeah.
What do we say about that?
St. Augustine distinguishes between lying and deception.
Oh.
A lie is where you're deliberately intending to signify something false by your speech. Okay. Deception is where you're intending to signify something true, but you foresee that someone else will misunderstand what you're saying because of the way in which you say the truth, okay? So those are two different things there. And I'll give you some examples. Our Lord, in the Gospel of St. Luke, after the resurrection, it says that he made as if he were going to go on further in the road to Emmaus.
Oh, yes.
And they begged him to stop. So he gave them an impression. Huh? He gave them an impression, and it was for a purpose, right? When you play sports, sometimes you're deceiving someone. The quarterback, you know, he pretends he's going to hand it off to the running back, and then he throws it instead, or whatever. And the same thing can happen in with regard to diplomacy and things like that. And all of that depends upon the prior question, namely, if the other people have a right to know or deserve to know. Right, the uh-huh. thing that you're that they're interested in knowing, right? And if they don't have a right to know, then it's legitimate to do something which can throw them off the trail, as long as it's not actually lying, right? It's not an actual lie where you're using your speech intentionally to signify a falsehood,
right?
Those aren't the exact same thing, and I know people think that might be splitting hairs. But there's a big difference between doing something that someone will likely misunderstand, where your intention is to signify the true, and actually intending to signify the false. There's really a big difference there.
That one where Christ makes as if he's going to go on, it kind of reminds you of like planning a surprise party for someone. You're actually doing it for their joy.
But you can't lie to plan a surprise party either, right?
I'm making a mental review now of any surprise parties. Have I lied before? I think, Father, I may have to talk with you privately after this.
Well, okay. Well, let's not do that on the air.
No. 888-318-7884 is our number. 888-318-7884. Let's go to John in Salisbury, Maryland, listening to EWTN on Sirius XM Satellite Radio. John, we might have to do the question before the break and the answer after, but your question for Father Sebastian Walsh.
Yes, good evening. I'm not sure if this is totally related to the topic, but it seems to me that God judges according to a person's knowledge. For instance, when Jesus said to the Pharisees, if you didn't know, you wouldn't be held accountable, but you say you know, and therefore your sin remains.
Yeah.
Same thing for somebody, for instance, a Catholic versus somebody who never heard the gospel. So if two people did the same sin, I guess they would be punished differently. How do you explain that on this topic?
That's actually an excellent topic, and it bears on the topic itself. So I don't know. What do you want to do, Si? Do you want to wait till the break, or do you want me to try and answer that in the next 2 or 3 minutes here?
Well, if I had 2 or 3 minutes, I'd give them to you, but the music is starting now, so wait till after the break.
On the other side there.
John, thanks very much for that question. Father Sebastian Walsh is our guest. Our topic is situational ethics. The number, 888-318-7884. We're happy to take your call. 888-318-7884. We'll be right back with more after this on Catholic Answers Live.
catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Coming to EWTN Television.
On November 13th and 14th, bishops from across the country will gather in Baltimore for their Fall General Assembly. EWTN will take you there live as the bishops are addressed by their new president for the first time. Receive an update on the recent convocation of Catholic leaders. Vote on several causes for canonization and more. Live coverage of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops Fall General Assembly begins Monday, November 13th at 10 a.m. Eastern on EWTN.
Face it, it's tempting and easy to be a man of the world. Father Terence Ehrman has a challenge for you. Be a man of God instead. In his new book, Man of God, Father Ehrman draws on his experience counseling men who are struggling to live in the world but not be of the world. In a unique, easy-to-read format, he offers holy spiritual direction for all men who want to master themselves and be transformed from within. Order your copy of Man of God today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Just like the saints of the Counter-Reformation, our own souls are in constant need of reform, of reconversion to God and His will for us. We struggle with sin. We become distracted in prayer. We find it hard to be loving and easy to be selfish. In Reform Yourself, Sean McAfee shows you how these magnificent saints can be guides to your own personal transformation. We all need to reform our souls. Let the saints who reformed the church show you how. Order your copy of Reform Yourself today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. As I've been saying, we want to give you Jimmy Akin for free. Not the man, but the talk. Jimmy Akin's talk, What the Reformation Was All About, a talk he just gave last month, or the month before last, I guess, at our national conference. We'll send you that free MP3. We just want you to sign up for Radio Club. And it's very easy to sign up for Radio Club. You just go to catholic.com/radioclub. You get the free MP3. You get a newsletter from us via email each week, and nothing else. We don't dump a bunch of emails and stuff on you all the time. And as new free MP3s come out, we'll send you those as well. Just go to catholic.com/radioclub to sign up. Father Sebastian Walsh is our guest. We're talking situational ethics. And when we went to the break, Father, John had asked you a question. Do you want to kind of set us up with what the question was and what your answer is?
Yeah, if I understood John's question correctly, the idea was something like this. That God, he looks into the soul and he sees everyone's knowledge, what they really know, and he judges us in accordance with what we know. And therefore, to that extent, the same person might, different people might do the same action and yet get different judgments from God based upon what they knew. And so I think John was asking, well, how does that fit in with situational ethics? Does that mean that every human action is really just judged based upon its situation or something like that, for example, what we knew? And that's an excellent question. It's really important for understanding correctly what we mean by situational ethics as opposed to, say, an idea of whether or not someone is culpable for their actions. So the truth of the matter is that there's a difference between judging actions and then making a judgment whether those actions can be imputed to the person who did them. In other words, how responsible is someone for their actions? So there's nothing wrong, for example, with saying that we can't know determinately the state of a person's soul before God. And when Jesus says, "You shall not judge," because God is the judge of all hearts, right? St. Paul even says, "I don't even judge myself. I don't have anything on my conscience, but the Lord's going to be the one who judges me." He says that. So we can't know determinately the state of someone's soul, namely their degree of responsibility for the actions they do. But that's not situational ethics. Situational ethics basically says this: not only can we never know the subjective or interior moral state of another person, it actually holds we can't even know the objective goodness or badness of the act itself without knowing all of the situations. And, of course, if you don't know all of the situations, which is in principle you can't know them all, you're actually never practically able to make a judgment about the goodness or badness of an act. The only person who would be in a position to do that is the individual who performed the act. And so one of the side effects or false consequences of situational ethics is that no one gets to make any kind of a judgment externally about someone, right? You can't make any kind of an external judgment about an act itself as opposed to the person, okay? I hope that helps. I think John's not on the air anymore, but hopefully he may well be.
John, did you hold on for all that?
Yep, I did.
And how does that strike you?
Yeah, it helped. I guess I can't make a judgment about anything.
No, you can make a judgment about actions, just not about individual persons' souls before God. But you can say torturing children is always bad, even if the person who did it isn't responsible because of some lack of knowledge. Who knows? Maybe they were under the influence of a drug or something that they couldn't do. But the act itself, you can make it a definitive judgment. That's a bad act. And the fact that the person was lacking knowledge doesn't make it good. So,
John, thanks very, very much for that call. Again, 888-318-7884 is our number. You seem to use for your example of a universally bad act, the torture of children. I assume you do that because some things that we might think of as universally bad acts, our society no longer sees them in that light. So
I try to use examples that everyone agrees on.
Yeah.
You know, there are a lot of things, for example, like fornication that used to be in our society something that everyone say, yeah, fornication is always wrong. But now people, they wonder about that. So I try to use examples that everyone agrees to, you know, and I think torturing children is a pretty good example. Molesting children, torturing children. I think those are really good examples that everyone can agree.
Right.
No matter what circumstance or situation you put that in, it's a bad thing.
We would hope. However, I do think we have raised a lot of real committed relativists in recent decades in our society. But I can see your point, though. You want to find something that people will assent to, yes, that's bad. That's always bad. I wish that were easier to do. I wish you didn't have to go to such extremes. But the case is that it's not. 888-31-TRUTH is our number. So there, you talk about the false aspects of situational ethics. And are there serious consequences that proceed from these if we have a false understanding of this?
Yes, someone might think, well, what's the harm in using situational ethics? It's one moral theory. Maybe it's got some flaws in it. But what's the harm? And there's some very serious harms that can come not only to the individuals who are striving to become good, but also to society as a whole, right? So, for example, if you admit situational ethics, there can never be intrinsically wrong acts, right, that are wrong all the time, okay? And so, practically speaking, anyone could claim that there are circumstances of which others are not aware, which makes their own act good. And that's going to make living together with other people impossible, and it'll destroy just order in society, because everyone will just justify themselves saying, you can't know all the circumstances, so you can't judge my act to be bad. You know, if you take situational ethics out to its logical conclusions, then, you know, people will just simply make the claim that they can't be punished, they can't be disciplined, they can't be corrected, because they're the only ones who can judge their acts are good. And, of course, they'll always claim their acts are good. So there's one serious consequence, right? But not only that, but since some morally relevant circumstances or situations are in principle unknowable by others, you could never have a moral evaluation of an act by anyone other than the person who does it. And that destroys the possibility of all moral education and even discipline of children. There's no way you could ever morally educate anyone or discipline anyone, or punish anyone for that matter. And of course, imagine the effects of that on raising new citizens, you know, raising up young people in a way that their lives are morally well-informed. So there's a lot of serious consequences. It's not just a matter of theory. It's a theory that fundamentally destroys the possibility of goodness in human persons and happiness, finally. It's a great impediment to happiness to have a false theory about what's good and bad in human actions. Now there's a great quote, by the way. I meant to read it earlier. It's a quote from Pius XII, and Pope Pius XII, and he gave a kind of a description of situational ethics so that you can sort of see it for what it is. And I wanted to read that quote. This is from a discourse to the World Federation of Young Catholic Women, And he gave these comments in April of 1952. And here's his quote. "The distinctive mark of such ethics is constituted by the fact that they are not based in any way on universal moral laws, such as the Ten Commandments, but on the actual concrete conditions and circumstances in which one must act, and according to which the individual conscience must judge and choose. This state of things is unique and valid once only for each human action. Thus, the decision of the conscience, affirm those who sustain such ethics, cannot be ruled by ideas, principles, and universal laws." So in other words, you can't give moral principles to help instruct people how to become better or live better lives. So that's a very serious consequence of this false theory.
I have to say, Father, in some ways I feel we're living that consequence, especially when we apply it to not to individuals but to cultures, that one culture doesn't have the right to judge another culture because the ethics that are internal to that culture are what should are the only value. There's no overarching ethics.
Yeah. But even that, the caller earlier alluded to this, I don't think anyone thinks that the Nazis, even though they were in, that in Germany had its own culture and people were, on board with that, I don't think anyone thinks it's okay to go and gas a bunch of Jews. I don't think anyone thinks it's okay to go and enslave a bunch of people.
Right.
You can say that, but that now gets a little bit into moral relativism more than just situational ethics.
I see, yeah.
Moral relativism is a more radical situation or a more radical ethical theory. But I always say, the only people that are moral relativists are the people who are powerful that aren't actually having an injustice done to them. As soon as you start having an injustice done to you, you're immediately a card-carrying moral objectivist. Right? So moral relativism is an ethical theory for the powerful who want to oppress others and don't want their oppressive actions to be resisted. So anyway, I don't think anyone who's really in a bad situation is a moral relativist.
Right. Yeah. Well, we'll go to calls, Father. It's striking me that when you say there are consequences, serious consequences to this kind of thinking, it was 100 years ago today that the Communist Revolution succeeded in Russia, which brought just decade after decade of misery, all based on ideas that you might have shrugged and said, well, I mean, that's not so bad. That's one person's philosophy. But these things do matter. And in time, they have very serious consequences.
I agree.
Paul in Minnesota, listening on Real Presence Radio, your question for Father Sebastian Walsh.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Continuing on with this Nazi Germany theme, what occurred to me toward the beginning of the program when Father mentioned that certain things are always objectively wrong.
Yeah.
But, one of the things he listed was to kill someone, and what occurred to me is the person that that's aware of Hitler's genocide in Nazi Germany and assassinates him, is
that wrong?
Is that morally wrong, or would that come under
great question.
Paul, I'm going to let Father take you. It's a little hard to hear you. So, Father?
Yes. I hope I didn't say it's always wrong to kill someone. I think what I said is it's always wrong to murder, which is to take an innocent life, huh? It's always the idea of intentionally taking an innocent life. So if you have a case of someone who's a tyrant, who's obviously unjust, and because of that, in order to stop them, the only way you could stop them is to take their life, it seems like that would not be a case of murder at all. It would just be a case of someone acting for the sake of punishing the guilty. It just happens that the person, there's no higher political authority to do it, therefore someone within the society or from another society would have to carry that out, that just judgment there. The church has never taught that capital punishment as such is intrinsically wrong, though there might be many circumstances in which capital punishment would be wrong. Huh? So the principle is not that taking a human life is always wrong. The principle is taking an innocent human life or murder is always wrong. And that's a case where, because an innocent person is always contributing to the common good. And so you can never directly intend to take an innocent human life. So,
But if you're going to kill a tyrant, for example, do the same rules apply as would in just war theory, that you'd have to have reasonable hope of success, that things would improve and all that?
St. Thomas Aquinas talks about that, the possible tyrannicide, and there's all sorts of conditions that have to be met before you would do something like that. I think it's too much to get into the details of that in this show, but all I want to say is that in principle, if someone is not an innocent person, in other words, they have done a crime that's public and knowable and worthy of death, or at least it can only be stopped. It's a serious enough thing that the only way you could stop it is by taking their life. In a case like that, in principle, you wouldn't be talking about murder at all. You'd just be talking about a just punishment there. And so it wouldn't fall under a case of an always valid moral norm, because the moral norm isn't you can never take a human life, but rather you can never intentionally take an innocent human life.
Paul, thank you very much for that question. We have to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Bringing you the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
I fell away from the practice of my Catholic faith in my college years. But after I got married and we were expecting our first child, I had an enormous tug to come back to my roots. I went to an incredible Catholic store in my town and was blown away by the kindness and knowledge of the staff. They not only recommended books for me and my bride, but they promised me prayer support for my journey back to the faith. Wow, what an incredible Catholic store. I have to credit them for helping me on my journey home to the Catholic Church. Now they consider me part of their family, and I have shared with them my oldest son's desire to become a Catholic priest someday. An incredible Catholic store in your area can be found at incrediblecatholicstore.com. That's incrediblecatholicstore.com. The Incredible Catholic Store, transforming the world one soul at a time.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their faith and values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Whatever I have learned, writes Catholic Answers founder Carl Keating, I have learned from the masters of the craft. In his new book, Booked for Life, a bibliographic memoir of an accidental apologist, Carl gives future generations a roadmap of what it takes and what it means to become a Catholic apologist. In the way only Carl can, he recounts numerous real-life situations he has encountered in his long career that illustrate the apologetic lessons he's learned. Then, drawing on a lifetime of experience, Carl reveals the books that helped him learn to defend the Catholic faith. Order your copy of Booked for Life today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to an all-Norbertine version of Catholic Answers Live today. Father Sebastian Walsh, our guest this hour. Next hour, our chaplain, Norbertine Father Hugh Barber, will be in here for an hour we like to call The Chaplain Is In. We're talking situational ethics this hour, and lots of calls, so I'm going to try to work my way through them. Julie in Portland, Maine, listening on the Presence Radio. Your question for Father Sebastian Walsh.
Yes. Hi, Father. I was wondering, for folks who do home faith formation with their kids, what's a good resource, you know, to begin talking about this issue? And my kids are like 10, 12, 13, around that age. Can you point to a good resource or
that's a good question. I don't know anything for kids of that age, to be honest. I think at that age, it's a little bit more just sort of catechesis. The age when they're really able to understand ethics as kind of a moral theory and principles is more around 16 or 17, I found in my experience. The most you can do is you can just explain to them the principles and just say, well, okay, there are some actions that are intrinsically wrong. That means if you do them, no matter what you do, no matter what the circumstances, they're always wrong. You know, you give them a kind of a catechesis like that without explaining all the principles. But as far as a work, there's maybe you could look and see in the Mother Divine Grace curriculum, they might have some things on ethics for kids that age. I don't know for a fact, so I don't know. There's a little work by Ralph McInerney called Thomistic Ethics or Ethica Thomistica that's probably for people that are young adults that would be a really good work to go through on just the principles of ethics and morality. That's the only thing I can think of, but again, that's for people that are much older who are actually going through and learning the theory about ethics. But I think it's not a good idea to try and teach the theory of ethics to 10 and 12-year-olds because they're not in a position yet to grasp all the principles. So more you want to just give right catechesis, in which case I would just use the resources from the catechism that just go through, you know, the parts about the commandments and the principles of ethics at the beginning of that section of the catechism. So I'm okay, sorry, I wish I knew something better for that, but...
No, that's okay, because I was just wondering, you know, for the younger ages, you know, what do you talk about? What do you, because it's everything is like moral relativism now, and you know, yeah. I almost feel bad for kids growing up these days. It's
yeah,
a harder world to grow up
for
in.
For young people, I like to point out that when it comes to moral relativism, this is something even young people like 10 and 12 years old can grasp. You know, my dad used to, when we were little kids, if we had to divide up a piece of cake, he would say, okay, you get to make the division, and then you get to pick the cake, the side of the cake you want. In other words, little children, even from a very young age, know what's fair, you know, and so they want to make sure that everything's divided exactly right or fairly, you know. And so I always point out, if moral relativism is true, in other words, if there's no such thing as an objective standard we can both appeal to say who's right and who's wrong, then you know who gets their way? The stronger one. And most kids figure out right away that's not a good theory of ethics, that whoever's strong gets what they want. Because if I want that piece of pizza and you do, and we both are moral relativists, so what's good for me is good for me, then the stronger one gets it. So moral, like I said, moral relativism is a theory for the oppressing class, who don't want the inconvenience of having to do something that other people, that is good for other people. So,
Julie, thanks very much for that call. We're still working our way through calls because just a little bit of time left. We go now to Carl in Dallas, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. Carl, your question for Father.
Thanks for your help, Father.
Sure,
I am a bit confused because it seems like some churchmen and theologians are now saying that we need to be flexible enough to understand that sometimes the Lord is actually pleased with sin, or he would be displeased if we didn't have sin because of our unique circumstances and because of the needs of others or some other need. And frankly, those arguments don't really impress me that much, but they are being pressed on me, and I wondered what your thought is.
Yeah. Again, if someone were to interpret, you know, church documents or whatever other, you know, historical moral theory from Catholic teaching as saying that it's ever acceptable to sin, that sin is ever acceptable or God is pleased with sin, then you can be certain that that is a false statement. Because what do we mean by sin? What we mean by sin is an act that is an impediment to our happiness. It's incapable of leading to our happiness. And since God loves us and he wants us to be happy, he could never be pleased that we're doing something that's preventing us from being happy. So that's the first thing. Is if you understand sin correctly, it's impossible in principle for God to be pleased with sin. Okay. The second thing is to realize sometimes we find ourselves in what looks like a moral dilemma. And a moral dilemma is one of these cases where you think no matter what you choose, you're doing something sinful. And the whole Catholic tradition and the whole moral tradition, not only philosophically, right, not just in the Catholic Church, but of the whole, you know, philosophical moral tradition that holds that the world is intelligible morally, holds that it's impossible in principle for you to have a choice where your only choice is sinning, right? You can always make a choice that prevents you from sinning. Let me take a simple example. Let's say that a man Let's see. I'm trying to think of a case. Let's say that a man is told, okay, unless you go and kill this innocent person, I'm going to kill your wife. You have to make a choice. Either you go kill that innocent person, or I'm going to kill your wife. Now, it looks like he's in a bad situation where you say, no matter what I do, I'm doing something wrong, because if I don't kill that man, this guy's going to kill my wife, and that's wrong of me to allow my wife to be killed, to choose that my wife would be killed. And it's wrong for me to actually choose to kill this innocent person, too. So either way, I have to choose something wrong. Well, what's really happening there? What's really happening there is that you're not responsible for one of those choices. Your choice is not to kill the man. And the other guy who's threatening your wife, he might kill your wife whether or not you kill that man. So the moral responsibility for the death of your wife in that case is not yours. It's a guy who kills your wife. So the right choice to make there is not to kill the innocent man and then see what the guy does with your wife. He might kill her or he might not. But you're not responsible for that choice. So all the cases where it seems like you have no choice but sin are really analogous to that case. Your action is not really a cause of the sin in both cases. It's only a cause of sin in one case. And the other case, the contradictory case, you're free from sin. So a lot of these cases where they say you have to commit adultery, for example, or if you don't commit adultery, then your children will starve. No, adultery is not the cause of your children being fed. What's the cause of your children not being fed is that someone's not feeding them, you know, and adultery doesn't save them or not save them. So all those different circumstances where people claim that you're forced to sin one way or another, so you have to choose a lesser sin, those are really just false examples, and each one of them could be unmasked if you just looked at them carefully.
Thanks, Carl. Let's try to get one more question in, if we can. Lynn in Louisiana, your question for Father Walsh.
Oh, hello. Have a situation where I haven't been invited to family get-togethers because I was dealing with sickness and everything. But now I'm able to go back to family dinners, and the holidays are coming up. And I have like a 22-year-old nephew who bought a house with a girlfriend, and they're living together.
Yes.
And everybody in the family, everybody's Catholic, but they're treating the boy and the girl as like, you know, family, like they don't want to be cut off from them and everything.
Lynn, I'm very sorry. You got to say it as a question real quick because we're about to be out of time. So the question is,
how do you handle that?
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Father?
Okay. There's such a thing as materially cooperating with evil. In other words, you don't have to endorse the evil that they're doing in order to stay in a relationship with your nephew. But nevertheless, you may be responsible to in some way give a fraternal correction to them if you're the only one who's in a position to do that, who's willing to do it. But if you do that, you have to do it charitably. Huh? But that doesn't mean you have to cut off your relationship or even not, you know, visit them and go to dinner with them during the holidays. Okay?
Boy, I think you set a lot of people's minds at ease right there, Father. Lynn, thank you very much for that quick statement of your question. Father, may we have your blessing before we go.
Per intercessionem Beata Maria Virginis et omnum sanctorum benedictio Dei omnipotentis Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti descendat super vos et mani et semper. Amen.
Amen. Thank you very much, Father Sebastian Walsh.
Thank you, Simon.
We always appreciate the time with you. Coming up next hour, another Norbertine. Father Hugh Barber will be here. That is for The Chaplain Is In. So if you have questions of a pastoral nature, start dialing now. 888-318-7884. We'll be right back after this on Catholic Answers Live.